Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Christine Lee Hireman. She is the Robert W. and Shirley P. Gimbel Professor of American History at the University of Delaware, and we're talking about her latest book, Doomed Romance, Broken Hearts, Lost Souls, and Sexual Tumult in 19th Century America. Christine, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Mark. Great to be here.
You really know how to write a title. And I actually don't say that lightly, because an awful lot of academics don't know how to write a title, but you really do. But the story lives up to the title. How did you get involved in this very intimate story with these people?
I have to tell you, this was a book that fell into my lap, almost literally. I was in the great state of Massachusetts doing research at the Houghton Library, kind of, you know, just shuffling through collections looking for my next project. And in a previous book, I had run across references to this romantic triangle in the otherwise staid and pious correspondence of evangelical missionaries in the 19th century Ottoman Empire. And I thought, gee, this is juicy, but there's such reticence in the 19th century speaking about matters romantic and sexual. I thought, all I'll ever get are these references. And then I stumbled across the names of two people in the romantic triangle in one of the Houghton's catalogs. And it was right before lunch, and I thought, oh, I'll bet this collection is two or three letters, and I'll just be frustrated and disappointed. But I'm going to take a look anyway. And the archivist comes out with this huge box and sort of whomp on the table.
As a historian, that must have been like nirvana.
Well, you know, I never has my heart beat
yes.
in an archive so fast.
I totally get this. I totally get that. Now, before we start, let's give out the three main people and who they were. And what time period are we talking about?
We are talking about what historians refer to as the early republic, and most of the action unfolds in the 1820s.
Now, the triangle, it's Martha Parker, who's a teacher, Thomas Tenney, who's a teacher training for the ministry, and this one, how do you pronounce his name? Elnathan?
It's Elnathan.
Elnathan.
It's biblical, of course. You know,
Elnathan Gridley. A minister right. preparing for a mission abroad. The amazing thing is, I always imagined the lives were so much more private then, but the things that you found out about these people because of this treasure trove were really amazing. I mean, it becomes a cinematic story.
Let's hope.
So you're not above that.
Far from it, Mark. Far from it.
Well, this is a really strange story, and as the reader proceeds through the book, and I want to make sure, and I want to make sure you're in on this, we are not going to give away the ending, and we're not going to give away the very interesting postscript that happens at the end of the book, okay? That's sort of like the cinematic denouement at the end, but Martha essentially promised herself to two people.
Well, seriatim, yes. First, she was engaged to Thomas Tenney, the minister in training, who is her second cousin. And then she gets literally a better offer from this missionary in training, Elnathan Gridley, and so she breaks the first engagement and agrees that she is going to become Gridley's wife, drawn by the prospect of a missionary career that in the first half of the 19th century, indeed throughout the 19th century, offered women not just meaningful godly work, but also a shot at renown and celebrity in ways that are difficult for us to imagine.
I was going to say, this surprised me in this book.
Yeah.
But it ends up, it's an incredibly desirable thing if you were a woman at that time period to be the wife of a missionary. Now, you know, I would imagine it would be incredibly tough, that you would probably die in obscurity. But in fact, a number of these missionary women wrote autobiographies that were bestsellers.
That's exactly right. In fact, if you were to compile a list of best-known women in the 19th century, you know, what's a name on every lip? You know, who's Lady Gaga in the 19th century? Most of them would be these female missionary wives, and then single women who enter the field. They really are these iconic cultural figures whose lives represent this exotic mixture of adventure and glamour, but also self-sacrifice and piety.
It really seems that to be a missionary wife, it was your chance to see the world too. Otherwise, your role was the homemaker.
Exactly. There are so few occupations open to women in the first half of the 19th century, and so few opportunities for adventure, for seeing the world. And so even though the death rate among these gals and their children through the ceiling, I mean, you're just taking an incredible physical risk, but the potential payoff was pretty super.
Let's talk about the evangelical community in America at that time. They were starting to change, and that's why this story becomes very important. They were starting to go through some sea changes about the roles of women.
That's a really good way to put it, Mark. Initially, and this is so hard for us today to wrap our heads around, because we tend to identify the evangelical majority with very conservative attitudes toward women and marriage, an emphasis on the subordination of women to men. And in fact, in the early Republic, first half of the 19th century, it is evangelicals who are, first of all, building important educational institutions for women, institutions known as academies or seminaries that are offering women an education that is comparable to what colleges are offering at that point only to men. And the other thing...
But they're not prepared to deal with the results of that. That's what it seems like in this book.
They
sort of teed up the situation without thinking it through about what it means when women finally start to get a taste of independence, that they're going to want the whole shebang.
Exactly. Yeah, they had no idea of the forces that they were unleashing, giving women an education, giving women opportunities for celebrity and renown, and offering women a role in civic life, in the public sphere, through their participation in voluntary, what are known as voluntary associations, groups that supported foreign missions, various kinds of moral reform that really allow women for the first time to step out of the household. So you're absolutely right. They have no idea of what's going to happen as a result of all of these innovations.
Yeah, it seems at times that they're trying to put the genie back in the bottle in this book.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a lot of contradictions. We were talking about the fame that these missionary wives attained through writing their autobiographies, but some evangelicals really disdained women who drew attention to themselves or exercised authority beyond their immediate home. And that sort of seems contradictory to these women becoming sort of famous writing their autobiographies.
Exactly. And of course, you know, what you've done is to really put your finger on the central tension in this movement. And it's probably fair to say that in the first half of the 19th century, if we're looking at northern evangelicals, that it's the more progressive folks who hold the upper hand in the movement. But over time, this is going to shift, and conservative evangelicals are going to seize control of the evangelical movement. And I think about Martha Parker's story and her and the way her life unfolds as illustrating this conservative backlash.
It's funny because I took sides pretty early on in the book. I was rooting for Martha the entire time. I did not like Thomas Tenney at all. But
he's the hard guy to like.
But that's my own personal take on this story, okay? And it's very personal and very subjective. But let's fill in some details and paint a little bit of a picture of who Martha Parker is, Thomas Tenney, and L. Nathan Gridley.
Sure. Well, Martha Parker is, we don't have any surviving image of her, but she is reputed by many people to be this beautiful, accomplished, and intelligent woman. She has been the beneficiary of an education in one of these new academies. She has been trained as a teacher, and she has a number of teaching gigs in these new academies that show her interest in offering a collegiate level education to women. The school that she founds in New Hampshire with her sister offers chemistry, for example, which is, you know, a knockout for the early 19th century. And she becomes engaged to her second cousin, Thomas Tenney, as I said. And then gradually, as she becomes more sure of herself spiritually, assured of her own salvation, as evangelicals would say, I think that this broadens her ambitions. And so when L. Nathan Gridley, the missionary, makes his overtures to her, she is willing to think of herself as somebody who can hit in that league, who could be one of these remarkable women in the mission field. And it's that ambition that prompts her to break her engagement to Thomas Tenney and to promise herself to L. Nathan Gridley. And Gridley has no idea that Tenney has been there before.
Now, Thomas Tenney, okay, again, just my personal reaction is this is a really interesting history because you end up starting to read it like a bodice ripper story. Because you get emotionally involved in it. Thomas Tenney, I just found really creepy.
So what's the ick factor for you? What was the creepy factor?
Well, he won't give up. And then you gotta talk about this. At one point, I think it was in Townsend, Vermont, he gets up there and does this hour long reading of why he deserves her.
Yeah, exactly.
I found that incredibly bizarre.
Exactly.
Talk about that incident, because I could just imagine sitting there in front of him listening to this. It must have been weird.
Right. And, you know, just for everybody else who we hope will read the book, he pursues Martha to the home of one of her sisters and brother-in-law, who's a minister in Townsend, Vermont. And he has literally written out and reads to them the entire history of his courtship of Martha.
Is this typical? Did people do this a lot?
Well, you know, I'll tell you what's typical is the spirit that prompts this. You know, he wants to get the sister and the brother-in-law on his side to say, oh, Martha, really, you should go back and marry this guy. You know, he's such a prize. Although they don't believe that, of course, and that's part of the problem for him. But I think what's typical is that Tenney is trying to prove that he is what folks in the 19th century would call a man of sensibility.
Right. This ends up being all wrapped up in masculinity. And the definitions of how men behaved at that time.
Right. You know, that you, if you are a Northern Yankee evangelical male, you want to show that you can stand up to women. This is very important in terms of vindicating your honor, but you also want to show that you are a man of refined feelings. And I think all of this goes into Tenney's initial confrontation with Martha in Townsend. And she is so taken aback, I think, that she says, well, you know, okay, fine. I won't go to Palestine. I will not accept the mission, and you and I can get back together. But then, you know, Martha has second thoughts about this, and Elnathan, who, you know, by now, of course, has to find out about Thomas Tenney, Elnathan supports her and says, you know, I'll go to Boston, I'll speak to the mission board,
oh,
I will defend your honor. There was an anonymous letter that came to the mission board accusing Martha of having broken the engagement.
Yeah. Do we have any real idea who wrote that letter?
Yeah, I think I do know who wrote it. And I think it's one of Tenney's friends,
right,
who was interested in Martha
Tenney's
romantically and who was jilted by her. Who hoped that he had a chance, but he didn't really have a chance. And so this is retribution for him, and this is guys sticking up for each other. And I think that there is strong evidence that the president of Dartmouth College, who is connected with the so-called anonymous letter writer, and other people who are kind of drawn to Martha Parker and are looking for their revenge, you know, that he is sort of enabling all of this too.
Well, it just sort of seems that the situation, and even today, a situation like this would be emotionally very complicated and there'd be families and upset and everything like that. But it rapidly spirals out of hand and all these other people get involved.
Right.
And let's talk about the American Board of Commissions for Foreign Missions.
Yeah.
What was their duties? What did they do?
Well, basically, they are in charge of orchestrating fundraising efforts and then managing the missionaries in the field. They get to say who goes and who doesn't. They get to say when people can come home. They are essentially in control of the entire cadre of people who are sent abroad and who are also missionaries to indigenous people within the United States.
Now,
so they hold all the cards.
That would be the sort of the bottom line institution that would determine whether she could go or not.
Exactly.
Now, it's headed by Jeremiah Evarts.
Uh-huh, yeah.
All these people, by the way, in their drawings at the time, always look severe. They always like, I'm really glad I don't know that person today. But let's talk a little bit about Jeremiah Evarts.
Evarts he's a lawyer by training, and he is someone who single-handedly has built the American foreign missionary enterprise into what is then the largest corporation in the United States. We are talking about very far-flung fundraising operations. He is the inventor of the direct mail campaign. And so he's a deeply pious guy who probably, if he's known to any of your listeners, he is the author of the William Penn letters that attack Andrew Jackson for the removal of Native people in the Old Southwest,
right,
on the deportation of indigenous people across the Mississippi River. So he's a fellow who does at least one good thing in his life, but and he means to, he starts out trying to do right by Martha Parker.
Right,
when
right,
he receives
right.
this anonymous letter, he is just, you know, sort of instantly thinking, oh, this is some crank. We've had these problems before. And really, you know, up until almost the very end, he seems bent on vindicating her from what he realizes is a smear campaign. So he's, you know, he has an interesting, complicated role.
Yeah, here. Yeah. And then you mentioned before the president of Dartmouth College, Bennett Tyler.
Yeah.
So what's his take on this situation?
Well, he's a tough-to-like guy,
yeah.
Much like Thomas Tenney, who he's mentoring to become a minister.
I rest my case. Go ahead.
Yeah. And Tyler is one of the leading lights of conservative evangelicalism at this point. And he is seeing up close and personal the way in which women are emerging as religious leaders, as moral reform leaders, as heads of academies, and are threatening the status of the young men that he is training at Dartmouth College. And he doesn't like the way that the winds of change are blowing, and he decides that he is going to make an example of Martha Parker. And indeed, he takes it upon himself to confront Martha in person and to tell her that by breaking her engagement to Thomas Tenney and marrying L. Nathan Gridley, that she is committing adultery.
Wasn't Thomas Tenney originally interested in Martha's sister, Emily Parker Kimball?
You know, it's hard to tell exactly what's going on there. At one point, before Martha entertained...
I just realized what a soap opera this is turning out to be, the way we're talking about it.
I can tell you're just deep into the gossip here. But he does. He proposes to Emily, and she just turns him down flat. In fact, both of Martha's older sisters think that Tenney is just unprepossessing, as they would say, and a loser, as we would say. And so, yeah, he's been turned down by the sisters and the one of Martha's older sisters, and the sisters are just completely befuddled when Martha sort of begins to entertain his overtures. But then he tells Martha that he only proposed to Emily out of a sense of duty, I guess, because she was the older sister. And but, you know, really he's always been stuck on Martha.
I know, it seemed like one of those sleazy situations where he was going after the sister, but he really wanted the other one.
Right.
Yeah, that's not good. That's not a winning situation.
Never good. Yeah.
A word is thrown around about Martha, a coquette. She was a manipulator, a person who, and from your book, adept at the act of arousing a man's feelings, then dismissing them.
Yeah.
That sounded like it was a harsh term then.
It was. And, you know, it comes from the first novel that is written by an American woman, Hannah Webster Foster. It is entitled The Coquette, and it is based on a true story about the seduction of a flirtatious but intelligent, charming woman, much like Martha.
Yeah.
And she comes to a very bad end, abandoned, pregnant, and then dies. But it is the sort of novel this is the novel that is read by every middle-class and elite woman in America from the time of its publication in the 1790s well into the 19th century. And to call someone a coquette has this specific meaning in the context of this novel. And what it means is, here's a woman who thinks that she can act like a man, that she can spread her charm around and use her looks and her intelligence and her verve to control men, and that such behavior, ladies, is going to get you in a lot of trouble. And so so when Martha is referred to as a coquette and fears that maybe it might stick, there's a real resonance right to that label.
I want to end that story there because I don't want to bring it any further, and I don't want to spoil the end, because this is a story that has a definite end and an important end and an important postscript too. But I just want to end. We just have a few minutes left. This sort of retraction that the evangelicals, the conservative evangelicals feel about women, that they only believe, belong in the home, affects the role evangelical women had in political issues that were about to come up, like abolitionism and women's rights. Evangelicals virtually don't play any role in them.
Yeah. And I'm so glad, Mark, that you brought that up, because you look at the women who are involved in the early women's rights movement, the women who turn up at Seneca Falls in 1848, and you find Quakers, and you
right.
find Unitarians,
right.
and women of, you know, generally liberal religious opinion. But evangelicals are in short supply, and you sort of shake your, you know, you scratch your head and you say, but, you know, evangelicals have taken the lead in women's education. They have taken the lead in giving women a role in these voluntary associations outside of the household. What the heck is going on here? Why aren't there
right.
more evangelical women in the early women's rights movement? And you'll have to read...
You have to read the
romance.
Book. That's right.
My answer.
We're completely out of time. My guest tonight has been Christine Lee Hireman. She is the Robert W. and Shirley P. Gimbel Professor of American History at the University of Delaware. And we're talking about her latest book. It's a book that you get caught up in. Doomed Romance, Broken Hearts, Lost Souls, and Sexual Tumult in 19th Century America. Christine, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks so much, Mark.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Goodbye.